Forensic Psychology is a podcast that provides an illuminating window into the workings of the criminal mind. Now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back. Right now, since I caught COVID, but we're back in business. And with me today is, of course, a good friend of mine, Andrew Bringle, former FBI profiler. He was in the FBI for over 27 years, and now he's the head of Behavioral Science Unit, LLC.com. So we're going to be talking about the tragedy over in the University of Idaho, where the four girls, or three girls and one boy was murdered. So let's welcome to the show, Andy. Welcome back.
Hey, Carlos. It was a long separation, 2 months. I was in Abu Dhabi.
That's right.
Yep. Enjoying the beautiful weather of Abu Dhabi. Now I came back to central New York, and it's on the 30s with 20-mile-an-hour winds off the lake.
We did miss the weather reports.
I do miss the desert sun for sure, but it's nice to be back. Christmas season is here. My 7-year-old daughter's looking forward to Santa Claus coming, and I'm looking forward to making sure she has a great Christmas. I also have one of my adult children come to visit this weekend. So, hey, I understand you're under the weather. I hope you feel better soon. It's not COVID, is it? Is it COVID?
It's COVID.
Oh, man. The COVID bug. In the second time you've had it?
No, it's the very first time. I avoided it for 3 years.
But,
finally caught me. Yeah. So again, folks, we'll talk about the murders. Andy's going to take most of the show. As you can tell, my voice is kind of disappearing. But Andy, you got a lot of insight on this one. We talked about this the other day. Did you want me to read the current story, or did you just want to take it away?
Yeah, you can recap. I just was going to say I've been asked to do a couple of media spots. I was overseas for one of them, but when I got back, I did one for another media outlet, and it gave me an opportunity to look at this case. And it's certainly an interesting case and a tragic one at that for the victims and the community. The fact that it's unsolved at this time certainly puts fear in many people's minds that are in the area, and the school is back in session for the next couple of weeks before the recess for the holiday. So my hope and prayers go out to those that are affected by the crime, and my best wishes to the three police agencies, the Moscow Police Department, the Idaho State Police, and the FBI that are assisting to find this person or persons who are responsible for this crime. Bring them to justice as quickly as possible.
I'll read a little bit of this. This is the latest from CNN 3 hours ago. They're going to recap some of the stuff right now. You know, unfortunately, they're regurgitating stories a lot right now because they don't have as much information, or the police aren't going to release it. And again, folks, you got to remember, they're not going to tell you everything because they need to be able to capture this person, so they don't want to tip their hand. Police investigating last month's killing still believe the attack was targeted, though they haven't concluded if the target was the residents or its occupants. The four students are Ethan Chapin, 20, Kaylee Goncalves, 21, Zana Kernodle, 20, and Madison Morgan at 21. They were found stabbed to death November 13th. So now it's been almost 18 days in an off-campus home in the college town of Moscow, upending a community that hadn't recorded a single murder in almost a decade, in 7 years. One of the things they were talking about, detectives do not currently know if the residents, or because they keep repeating the same thing over and over again, the story, they're trying to make it longer than it is. They remain consistent in their belief that this was indeed a targeted attack. They're not sure whether or not the public has anything to worry about. They've kind of given confusing statements about that. Early on, they said it was an isolated targeted attack and there's no longer a threat to the community. Now they've backtracked it. Authorities publicly maintained investigators believe the killings were targeted. This is like the fifth time in this article. Right. Until they're trying to really extend this article as much as they can.
Right.
They've conducted 150 interviews. 1,000 tips from the public have been received so far. That's really about it. The crime scene was horrific, they said. A lot of blood everywhere. Andy will talk a little bit more about that in a minute when we get into the particulars. I'm just trying to look right now, Andy, anything else that I can see. On the night of the killings, two of the girls were at a sports bar, and the boy and the girl, the other boy and girl were seen at a fraternity party. Investigators believe all four victims had returned to the home by 2 a.m. the night of the stabbings. Two surviving roommates had also gone out at night and returned to the house by about 1. Police said initially the two girls returned to the home by 1:45, but they later updated the timeline, saying digital evidence showed that the pair returned around 1:56 after visiting a food truck and being driven home by a private party. Two surviving roommates the next morning summoned friends to the residence because they believe one of the second floor victims had passed out and was not waking up.
Right.
When police arrived, they found two victims on the second floor, two victims on the third. There was no sign of forced entry or damage. Investigators do not believe the two surviving roommates were involved in the deaths. That's pretty much the latest. Some of it's the same. Not very much
here, let's go. Let's backtrack a little bit. Okay. So to address some of the issues that you brought up, the targeted versus non-targeted and why the police might say that. A couple of reasons. The police's articles I read have backtracked because of they based it on miscommunication between their office and the prosecutor, the county prosecutor, who suggested that these crimes might have been a targeted crime. But when you look at the why behind that and how they develop an investigative theory, there are three floors in this home. There were victims on the third floor and the second floor. There were two young ladies that were murdered, tragically murdered on the third floor, Madison and Kaylee. They were sleeping in the same bed. And then in the second floor, Zaina and Ethan were in a bedroom and they were also killed. But there were two roommates on the first floor that were spared. So the police theory at the time might have been that, and this is conjecture, but they might have looked at it as a target attack because two victims were left alive on the first floor. That's one. The second is by telling the community that this is a targeted attack, they're inferring that no one else has to worry, that there's not a wild or crazy serial killer running loose in Moscow. And to assuage those fears that people might have, because the students were coming back from Thanksgiving break and they were going to be back on campus for 2 weeks for finals. So it might have been an attempt to kind of calm the community and try to prevent hysteria. In any case, they're now looking at all of the evidence and they're leaving things open. So they're not saying it wasn't targeted. They're simply saying that they're not going to say it was targeted. It could be or couldn't be. They're two theories. So let's backtrack again in terms of how these cases evolve. When you have an investigation, there's only one of two ways they open, right? You either have someone call you in, say, hey, I'm a victim of a crime, or I'm about to be a victim of a crime proactively, right? Or you have a crime that's already committed, and that's what you have here. So the police are truly law enforcement because now they're reacting to a crime. There was a phone call to 911 about this unconscious body. In fact, it was four dead bodies. But the police arrive, and what they didn't know at the time was that the two surviving roommates had called two friends. I'm making an assumption that they were male friends because they thought something was amiss in the house. And so they brought these two other individuals who then contaminated a crime scene. Right. So now the police have four bodies. Never mind the fact that they haven't had a murder in 7 years, but now they're confronted with this very extremely violent attack against four individuals. It, other people that have been inside this home, not just the four that were there, the two roommates and the two young men that were called, or two people that were called. We don't know they were male. But also other people that had been in that home recently, because that was known as a party home. So they have to then contain all that evidence so that they can later review it and try to figure out who was responsible for the crime. So I think the first part of this is, why did they backtrack? I don't think it was anything nefarious or incompetent on the part of the police. They're simply doing their job. They're looking for the subject that's responsible for these crimes. And they also want to create a mass hysteria in the community. By the way, in typical of these cases, you and I have talked about others, in the types of cold cases and active cases. that when there's a lot of publicity on an investigation, you start getting thousands or hundreds of tips, in this case, over 1,000 tips, leads, and each one of them have to be worked, right, and reviewed and analyzed. And so tremendous pool on manpower for a small department, which is why they called the state police in. And the resources, particularly forensic resources, extremely important, but also, you know, timely. And so they had to call in the FBI to get federal resources. So, yeah, so that's the how I would open our conversation on this before we get into the crime scene and whether it's a serial killer or a targeted attack.
And a couple of things I wanted to ask you quickly here. One thing for folks to know out there, theories are not facts. They're just theories. Right. And a lot of times the media doesn't portray it that way. They'll just portray it as, oh, this is what they believe. And people misunderstand it sometimes. I mean, not all of the media's fault. Sometimes just people misunderstand it. But theories are not facts. And I guess my question to you is, are multiple theories are common, aren't they, in these type of investigations?
So I used to teach the investigative process to brand new FBI agents. So again, going back to my earlier point, you either have somebody call and say, I'm about to be a victim of a crime, or I was a victim of a crime, or police respond to a crime scene, which is what happened here. Immediately, you start containing that site if it's a crime scene, and you're human, right? You're an investigator. So you go into the investigative mode and you start creating an investigative hypothesis, right? A question of how this crime could be committed or was committed. And so almost immediately, you start looking for the right questions to answer. And then the collection of evidence and the analyzing the evidence and then the collection of witnesses and interviewing those witnesses. And then the deductive process of having suspects of maybe a half dozen or a dozen and a half, and then reducing that pool. And so you've heard that in this case, right? You've heard that the driver that brought the two young ladies back to the house has been cleared. The boyfriend has been cleared. The guy at the food truck has been cleared. The two roommates have been cleared. All we've heard is that the police are doing their job and they're interviewing these people. And at this time, these individuals are no longer people of interest, persons of interest by the investigators. Now, having said that, things could change. Evidence can come to the front and lead them back to an individual that they've previously said was not part of it. But if what we have, and this is all, I preface our comments, both of our comments, by this is all open source information. Neither one of us have access to the information that the police have. And your earlier point is absolutely correct. The police aren't going to just show everything they have. There is a killer out there, right? And so they have to catch that killer first, but they also need information that only the killer knows. And so they want to hold it. Here's a couple points to think about, though. This particular kind of crime scene is extremely brutal. It is savage. People don't just die like in the movie with one stab wound. There were multiple stab wounds to the upper torso and face by this person. There's two sides to look at that. One from the victim. When you get stabbed with a knife, you don't die instantly. And your reaction is to fight back. So multiple, we don't know how many, but the press is reported multiple victims showed defensive wounds. Right. So so you have people
DNA that, under the nails.
Well, yes. Yeah, so that's one thing. So, you know, they'll be looking at forensically the DNA that the victim's fighting back, may have clawed the subject, the perpetrator. So he may have left some DNA at the crime scene. So they'll be looking at that. But beyond that, the victims had to have yelled. There were four of them. Even if you're stabbed in bed sleeping, you don't stay, you know, you don't die instantly, right? So that had to be a lot of noise. It might have awakened a person or two. Could he have cut their throats? We don't know. We don't have access to that. The press hasn't reported that, but we know that they were stabbed. This is what the press is saying. They were stabbed in the upper torso several times and in the face. So again, you get stabbed, you don't die instantly. The other part of that, from the flip side, the person that's committing this act on four people, it's bad enough to stab one person to death. It's a traumatic event for both. Without defending yourself, right? And you're stabbing that person and the blood that's coming out of that person and onto you is going to make you, you know, you're going to be very bloody. You're going to leave your fingerprints with blood, or your footprints. You're going to step in the blood and leave a shoe print. So the police, I believe, have over 109, I think, photographs of the crime scene. There's been over 100 interviews of witnesses, and there's been over 103 pieces of evidence collected. There have been over 1,000 leads, 488 digital leads alone to the FBI's hotline. The governor has released $1 million for this investigation. So there's a lot of investigative effort that's going on here. There's a lot of forensic evidence that needs to be looked at. Now, let's look at the crime scene itself. Whether it's a targeted attack or not, there's a guy named Roy Hazelwood. He was a profiler well before. He's one of my heroes, right? And well-known, well-authored individual. He passed away not that long ago. But he's the one that's credited with the concept of organized and disorganized crime scenes. And when they're applied, and two theories that I would look at in this case. One is it's a serial killer, right? And if that's the case, then the house may have been targeted. These individuals may have been targeted. You could be a serial killer and be targeted. This right now is defined as a mass killing, 4 people killed in one location. It wasn't a spree killing. He didn't go to another place and kill a bunch of people. It could still be a serial killer who is either organized or disorganized. And that quite honestly, the serial killer could have known the victims, right? So there are some differences between organized and disorganized crime scene. And I know that some recent research has looked at these kinds of cases and debunked some of the theory that Roy came up with. But Roy broke them down into two. And a serial killer that's organized is usually married. They have a family or they've been in a relationship. John Wayne Gacy, Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, some examples of that. Disorganized crime scene serial killers typically aren't in a long-term relationship. They have an inability to maintain a relationship. Oftentimes, they are borderline personality disorders. And so however, disorganized crime scene or disorganized serial killer often commits his crimes under the use of alcohol or drugs. And so, when you're talking about somebody stabbing a bunch of people, multiple people with a knife, it kind of lends itself to these people who are these types of serial killers or type of killers that fantasize the murder and the violence. And oftentimes, like Richard Chase, a serial killer who was abusing alcohol, LSD, and marijuana, it could be someone who's that is in drug induced when they commit these crimes. Another is that an organized serial killer oftentimes stalks the victim. They have a plan and a methodology in which they want to engage the victim and often control the victim at the time of death. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, is an example of that. Planned his attacks methodically, picked out they enjoy the hunt, so to speak. So perhaps, this individual was a stalker. I think one of the victims had reported having a stalker. The police are still looking at that lead. The disorganized serial killer doesn't generally stalk the victim. They will take victims as crimes of opportunity. They also don't hide the body, which is often the case in an organized, or position the body. Danny Rawlings in Gainesville, Florida, chopped the heads off of his victims and then positioned the body so that it looked like it was in prayer and the heads were pointed back towards the body in a macabre kind of setting. The other thing about organized serial killers is they'll often keep a trophy of the crime. They want to relive the crime. And you don't see that as often in disorganized crime scenes and serial killers. Yes.
And none of that, we don't know for sure yet either on this case, any of that stuff yet, have we? Have we seen anything in regards? They wouldn't tell us
the about evidence. The open source evidence hasn't shown that. What we can infer from this particular case, from the crime scene as reported by the media, is that it was excessive. And that's an indicator of a disorganized crime scene. Excessive or overkill is one, as Roy would say.
No body positioning either though, right?
No body positioning that's been reported, but we know that the excessive force, like this was overkill with the stabbing and the blood was literally running out of the house. That's how much blood was spent from the victims. Another thing that's interesting, and this may play into this particular case that, you know, and I said this the other day on news, that my feeling is that this individual knew these people and is hiding in plain sight, is more than likely a local. And that's what you see from a disorganized crime scene and a disorganized serial killer, is that they usually live near the crime scene. Another example is Richard's Chase. He lived very close to the victims, within a mile or so. They're often unskilled workers. So an unskilled worker or a student, young male, somebody who thinks, you know, has worked out and thinks he could overtake someone with just a knife. He took four people out. He didn't know any of those four people could have had a gun. It's a high risk endeavor to go into a home in the middle of the night unless you know the layout and the people. So I would tend to think that, you know, obviously this is a disorganized crime scene from the information we have from the media. So it's obvious to that point. And it seems to me that, you know, whether or not this is a serial killer, this is someone who fits that model of a disorganized killer. The other thing about organized crime crimes and those types of killers is they often have a killer kit, you know, and back at the behavioral science unit down in the research center, we had several of those that were collected from previous serial killers. They travel, so they're more widespread crime patterns. I mentioned VICAP out of the behavioral analysis units. So they track these types of killings across the country. And so I'm sure part of the FBI resources not only includes a database search, but also the development of a potential profile, which I'll get to in just a moment. And the other thing about organized crime scene or serial killers is that they, like Ted Bundy, have usually a high IQ. And of course, Bundy was responsible for the Chi Omega sorority murders. So there's a lot of people that have tied that back into to this case, that this might be a serial killer. There's also the fact that about 2 months, 3 months ago, there was a couple in the area that reported their dog had been not only mutilated, but skinned. And of course, there's a correlation between sociopathic behavior, serial killers, and the mutilation of animals. So people have drawn that connection, which may or may not be connected at all. And then I think in Oregon, about 400 miles away, a couple was brutally stabbed while they were sleeping in bed. Again, police will look at these cases and they'll see if there's a similarity. And many serial killers will leave a signature, some kind of mark that draws to their particular personality and psychoses, their need to live this crime. And so the police have not released that if there was something that would draw back to the particular killer.
And they won't either.
And they won't.
Until after the case.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. The other big difference is, and the weapon has gotten a lot of attention. You know, where is this weapon that I think is a K-bar knife is what they're describing it as, a fixed bladed knife. In an organized crime scene and serial killer, they will take the weapon with them. They usually bring the weapon with them. Dennis Rader had a gun. So in this particular case, the weapon was taken, it appears. They've looked at dumpsters in the area. They recently took the five cars that were parked out in front. I don't know why it took a week and a half or so for them to get the cars, but yesterday they pulled the cars to look at the evidence there. But a disorganized crime scene and a disorganized killer will often use an improvised weapon. Doesn't seem to be the case here. It seems to be that they brought it, but that may change. They may show some evidence that the weapon was there all along and he took it, but we don't know that for sure. The other thing that's critically important in this particular case, as cases run, is a timeline. And so you'll see that in the media. There's actually several articles that try to draw the timeline. The four victims all arrived home about the same time, around 1:30 in the morning, thereabouts. You know, two of them were at a party at a sorority house. Two of them were at another bar, and then the food truck then drove home. All four of them arriving about the same time. By the way, the two young ladies that were spared, they arrived home about 30 minutes earlier. So everyone around 1 o'clock to 1:45 were at the house. The two young ladies that were on the third floor, that would have been Madison and Kaylee. They were on the phone with, I believe, Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, trying to reach him, several phone calls up till about 3 o'clock in the morning. So they were killed between after 3 o'clock and before 11:58 when the police were called. So, and then, you know, the others were called before that. So it's probably about 11:30. Yep.
Was it 11:30 or 1:58?
11:30 in the morning. Oh, 11:58, the police responded, right, to an unconscious body. But assuming that they called these other young men, or who I assume they were men, but these other two people that came to the house before the police. So let's say 11:30, 11:15, we can just make an assumption. So you figure the murders had to have occurred after 3 and before 11 in the morning. So you're talking, what, 8 hours, that window that the murders occurred. And the importance of that is that, and the coroners will do their best to determine the order in which these victims died by blood splatter. You know, going by the theory that he's stabbing one person, getting their DNA on them, and then going to the next victim, and there's DNA, then the first person's will be on the second victim, but not the second victim won't be on the first, and neither will the third or fourth be on the first, right? So they should be able, hopefully, pattern the order of victims, and that will help in the analysis and the profiling of victimology. Who would this person have known? Who would this person have known that wanted them dead, perhaps?
Yeah, there's a lot of information we don't. By the way, a couple of days ago, a couple of reports came out. Police departments are not linking the Oregon one anymore.
They're not?
This one. At least that's what a couple of reports that I just saw.
Good. Yeah.
7 days ago, it said they were looking at it. 4 or 5 days ago, it said they were not. So I don't know if that's conclusive or not, but just FYI.
Yeah. And it's, again, and this is just me based on the information that I've seen and read. And then studying it for the purposes of being on another show a couple of days ago, I'm not convinced it's a serial killer. If it was a serial killer, you have to have other cases to compare it to, and they'll be doing that with VICAP. The circumstances in this particular case lead me to believe that this appeared to be a targeted attack. Targeted in the sense that it may be one individual, and the other three were, you know, collateral victims. Or that this person had a vendetta or some animosity towards that particular home, that party home. Maybe it was someone who was rejected at a party. You know how cliquey universities can be and university campuses. So this was known as a party house. Part of the problem is trying to identify who had access to the home, ingress and egress, because as I understand it from open source, the first floor door, which actually opens to the front of the house, right, which would have exposed the killer much more. So it appears that he didn't come through that door, which had a cipher lock, you know, like a combination lock that everybody in the town knew, evidently, that partied at that house. The second floor was a sliding glass door that wasn't locked, evidently. There was no forced entry. The other thing that's interesting about the targeted attack is there was no sign of sexual abuse or rape. The dog, interestingly enough, did not alert on the intruder. At least there's no report that the dog barked or tried to wake anyone up. And he also wasn't hurt. The dog was not hurt, which is interesting. I don't know what type of dog it was or is. This individual seemed to know the layout of the home, whether he started the second floor and then went up to the third floor or went to the third floor directly, that would be telling. And that could be determined, I believe, by the blood trail from the subject. If he kills the two people upstairs, there's probably blood coming down that they could identify that would show his pattern of travel. If he kills the people on the second floor, then goes up, then there may only be blood coming back down instead of up and down. So that would be something that the police are going to be looking at to determine the order in which these victims might have died. There was no one bound or gagged, at least reported by the police. And you're right, your earlier comment, there could be some evidence that they're just not sharing with the public. But it doesn't appear that this killer took his time, you know, to torture, gag, bound these individuals. It looked like he went in with a purpose, kill these people and then get out as quickly as possible. And I have talked to others, and it is possible that he killed the people, you know, the women at the third floor, woke up the two on the second floor on his way back down. What's the female? Zanna may have, she seemed to have some defensive wounds. Maybe she woke up, couldn't get Ethan up because he was killed in the bed. She died, I believe, outside the bedroom, from what I've read. So if that's the case, maybe he startled her, had to kill her, then went and killed him, and then simply thought, you know what, I got to get out of the house before I get caught, and never got to the first floor. But no one was bound. Nothing was stolen. So you and I have talked about motive, right? It's one of the things that we look at, you know, in the behavioral science unit, is what was the motive? And we use a taxonomy, you know, categories called PEPs. PEP stands, as you know, for personal, economic, power, or political and social. So we can ask ourselves, is there any sign that he committed this act for the group, you know, on behalf of a gang or some other kind of social group? It doesn't appear to be. Doesn't appear to be any kind of satanic cult or anything like that. We can rule out that he did it on behalf of a group, a social group. Did he appear to do this based on power or some political statement? Doesn't appear to be that either. Did he take anything of value? Does the police are not reporting any robbery, any money being stolen, anything like that. So that leaves personal. And I think that the evidence points to the fact that this person either had a personal vendetta or was, as we mentioned earlier, a person on some kind of psychotropic drug or alcohol-induced stupor that led them to the horrendous, heinous crime of killing these four people. But critical to this, and this, I want to hear your opinion, but it's the order. When I was asked the other night, you know, what's the question, I answered it, you know, the chronology, the timeline is critically important because that timeline will tell the police a lot in terms of the possible victimology. You know, there's a show, an old show on TV called 48 Hours. Mm. And in murder cases, in all cases involving murder, the first 48 hours is critically important. Most murders are committed by people that knew the victim. In this case, there are four victims. So the police have done, I think, a very good job of trying to identify those people closest to the victims at the time of the murder. And with each passing day, they expand that to associates and to possible, you know, acquaintances that may have some involvement in this. They have a lot of evidence of, like I said, 4,000 pictures at the crime scene alone. They got blood. They've got to look at the blood splatter. They've got to look at the victim's wounds. They've got to look at DNA. They have a lot of work to do, possibly leading them to the individual that was responsible for this. So it's a tragedy any way you look at it. And there's not a whole lot left to discuss in terms of the facts, because it just isn't a whole lot to look at.
No, I mean, the only... I'll just throw a couple of things in regards to theories or things to think about out there. One is, as Andy mentioned, it could be somebody who's got a vendetta. It could be a vendetta against all four. It could be a vendetta against two of them, like Andy was saying. It could also be a combination of the vendetta plus drug use. I hate to say, because I know some people are going to misconstrue this, but the majority of people with schizophrenia are not violent. So I'm going to preface it first. Okay. However, if this kind of a case, it'd be interesting to see, because of the age group, that's usually the time frame that you start getting schizophrenia. Aggression goes up in people with schizophrenia between 18 and 25. So if you do become violent, that's usually the area, is the time zone that you're looking at age-wise. Second, if it is, it could be a psychotic episode that happened, which could explain the ferocity of the killing, the violence that happened. It could be induced by additional substances that could increase the susceptibility to psychosis, which is another factor. So if the person does have schizophrenia and they're taking substances, that could heighten everything that could have happened. There's a lot of variables, folks, but I'm just throwing things out there because the way the crime's being described to me, not by Andy, but by the open source and by whatever Andy's saying as well, it definitely seems something's off here. This person's definitely got a lot of anger, whether it's targeted, how do I phrase this? Targeted realistically or targeted delusionally. How I explain that is they felt slighted, discriminated against, marginalized, whatever it is by this group, or it's a psychosis or a delusion like Hinckley and Foster and Reagan, where they think something is happening and these people are picking on them and nothing's going on at all, but they think they're deluded.
Those are good points. My feeling at this time, and again, you know, when you do a proper analysis of behavior, quote unquote profile, you have a lot more data points than what we have at our advantage. But based on what I think, what I see, I think that this is a young male, 20 to 20, mid 20s, who is on the campus, knew these victims, possibly went to school with these victims, perhaps even attempted to date one of the two victims, or one of the three women that were victims. This is an individual who has excessive anger, anger impulse, probably using some type of drug. I don't know if it's a psychotropic, but it's certainly alcohol and cannabis. This is an individual who more than likely is a hunter or ROTC student, the type of knife used, and as someone who has used a knife before, it probably skinning animals, hunting. I'm not suggesting in any kind of psychotic way, but somebody who feels comfortable using a knife,
probably poor personal skills too is my guess as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is somebody who has had a hard time maintaining relationships with other people and is, you know, just filled with rage and anger. That would be my assessment at this point. The whole process is deductive. So they will have a number of suspects and they will whittle that down to those that are the most likely involved.
I just have two more questions before we wrap up. Any talk about cameras? I don't know what that part of town has.
That's a great question. So here's how that works. You know, it's sort of like the rock and a pebble in the pond effect, right? So you start at the crime scene and you look for evidence, forensic evidence, including cameras. So CCTV cameras around the house, right? Is there a canary or is there a ring, anything that might have recorded? So police are not sharing that if there is, but they'll look at that first. Then they'll go out to the neighborhood. In a neighborhood that size, I think there was apartments very close by. So they'll look at those cameras. They'll do a canvas of the neighborhood and they'll look at that. And then they'll, as they build that timeline of activities, the food truck and others, I think they released some CCTV footage showing the young ladies at the food truck. So they'll look at the timeline and they'll go back to at least the time that they were at the sorority house and the club, because they know they're alive there and they were engaging in other people. So it is possible that somebody followed them back home from either the club that the two women were at, and they'll do extensive investigation of that club and the videotape of that club. And that's going to take time, by the way, and try to find out if there's anybody that engaged those young ladies while they were at that nightclub. The same thing is true at the sorority house. My guess is they're focusing on the two young ladies that were Kaylee and Madison. They were at the nightclub. They probably engaged in, you know, they're very attractive women, so they probably engaged with a number of individuals, and those individuals may then become persons of interest. There is an ROTC program on that campus. The military does use a K-bar type knife. But my thinking is, you know, hunters use that same kind of knife to skin deer. And that's that would be my supposition at this point, based on the information that's been released. This is a male, young male in his 20s. This is a high-risk behavior, going into a home with just a knife, where there are multiple occupants in the middle of the night to effectively kill at least one individual. And so I think this person's still on campus, and that's why perhaps the police thinking about releasing the information about being targeted, they want to be also responsible. They don't want to say, hey, there's nothing to worry about. And then they end up with another murder.
I guess my last question is, you kind of alluded to it earlier that you think the perpetrator is still around town.
Yeah.
You still think that then?
I still do. Yeah, I still do. I think that person's, hiding in plain sight and hopefully does not strike again. But if this is a serial killer case, and I'm not suggesting it is, as I've clearly said, I think this was a targeted attack. But if it is a serial killer, then they're going to be compulsed to do this again. And if it's based on the history and science of disorganized serial killer, will strike it locally. Disorganized serial killers don't travel as opposed to the organized serial killers. So typically they don't. So this seems like, to me, it seems like a target attack, but the police have to open both theories until they have more evidence pointing them in the proper direction.
And just to kind of give you some information, folks, the town, I think Moscow has a population of 25,000. I believe the University of Idaho has got about 12,000 people.
Yeah.
So not huge, because I'm assuming out of that 12,000, it's probably about 60% female.
Yeah.
Maybe 70. So you've got about 4,000 or 5,000 male suspects there. And then you go to the population of the city, you probably got another 8,000 males. Probably going to be some overlaps. It's probably going to be about 10,000. And if it's even from that city, might not even be from that place.
And when I say local to the effect that if this is a young man at college, he's, local during the school year and may in fact not be local after. They may be going, he may travel wherever he's from. And I say he, it's not absolute that it was a he. Neither is it absolute that it was only one. It appears that only one perpetrator, and they would know that by, again, blood prints for hands or feet, and they could tell whether there's multiple subjects, but there's been nothing released on that. So I'm going to work off the assumption that it's only one person. And again, over the assumption that they're local, at least through the school year.
Yeah, to me, and this is not a judgment call at all in the law enforcement agency. It's just remarkable. It's been over 2 weeks for such a heinous crime. Wow, you don't see them that often happen like this.
Yes and no. I mean, I've worked some of these types of cases, that go cold quickly when there's not a clear association. Most murders are even crimes of passion, as this has been described. But and it may not be. But in those cases, you have a clear correlation between the victim and the perpetrator. You don't seem to have that clear connection in this case. The people that closest to the victims have been, quote unquote, cleared at this time. So that's, at this time, those individuals, the former boyfriend and the driver, I don't think it was Uber, but whatever driver that was, service that was, the food truck guy. They've all been, huh?
Was it snowing?
Was it snowing?
I don't know. I wonder if that's going to mess up the footprints leading out of the house. There's no way he's getting out of that house without footprints walking out of that house. So I'm wondering.
He's got to be covered in blood.
Exactly.
So there has to be some.
Unless he's hiding in the woods, I don't know that area well enough.
Yeah, they. I know they took the three dumpsters, looked through that, didn't find evidence that they're releasing anyway. Then they just yesterday, and this was a big. Again, I'm not second guessing the police. I think they're doing a fine job with the resources they have and the time. But they took the five cars. There were five cars out in front, and I don't know why it took the number of days it did before they could secure those vehicles, but they'll be looking through those vehicles for evidence as well. I'll tell you, whether it's the bombing case you and I have talked about in the past, or the Kerry Lawson case, which we've talked about in the past, and other very difficult cases that have resolved themselves. The Atlanta murders, Williams was involved. It was months and months, and this was a serial killer, and they found the carpet fibers that led them to the conviction. It will be a break like that in this case, that the hard work will pay off, that the locals, the state and the feds are doing. I can tell you this from personal experience. There are a lot of tireless days and long nights that are being worked since the middle of November to resolve this case for those victims and their families and the community. And so I I wish nothing but the best for those that have been affected by this heinous crime and the police that are working diligently to resolve it. Wouldn't it be great if the correct individual just, you know, turned themselves in, but that's not how it happens in these cases. Through hard work, they'll find the individual and the evidence will tie them to the crime scene.
No, that's good points. I think we'll wrap up on that. Great insight again, Andy, like always, my friend. Again, folks, go to behavioralscienceunitllc.com. Check out more what Andy's up to. I think
hey, you know, I want to plug. I do have a couple plugs. I want to plug our podcast, Inside the Criminal's Mind, which they can find on multiple platforms, from Spotify to Apple to all the other ones you put it on. But the other one, which we need to get back and do, is The Psychology of Romance. Getting a lot of good reviews on The Psychology of Romance. And I want to get back to do, I have a couple other ideas for that one. So it's nice to be back from Abu Dhabi. And I'm looking forward to the Christmas season. I wish you the best of holidays and merriest of Christmas. And to all our loyal fans out there, spread the news that Dr. Carlos and Andy are back.
I'm glad for it. Have a great holiday. I'm sure I'll talk to you for the holidays, Andy.
Yeah, I'm sure. I want you to feel better first.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You know what to do. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button, and we'll talk to you all later.
Bye, Carlos. Talk to you later.
Bye.